Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. Today is going to be a fun one because we are talking about witchcraft and magic with a guest who's been involved with the modern witch movement here in the U.S. almost since the very beginning. Today, it seems like more witches than ever are proudly out of their broom closets, and we are definitely moving toward a place where the word witch is becoming more commonplace and acceptable. But as a mom of two little kids, I can tell you that we still have a long way to go. Every Halloween since preschool, my kids have come home with coloring pages and stories of witches that provide the same old, tired caricature. It's some old lady with a green face, a wart on her nose, and a loud cackle. And my kids have gotten so tired of me trying to set the record straight that they now just say, "We know, Mom. We know. A witch is a wise woman." But that's exactly what she is. Even the word witch in many regional languages throughout Europe once meant exactly that. It meant wise woman or healer. Witches have always been the keepers of women's ancestral wisdom. And for this and for a combination of fear, ignorance among common folk, and a hunger for power by patriarchal religions, they were murdered by the hundreds of thousands and possibly millions. So no journey to reclaiming the wisdom of the sacred feminine is complete without also proudly reclaiming the word witch and all that it stands for. And with that, I am thrilled to introduce you to my guests today. Caradhwen Fallingstar is a shamanic witch and priestess who has taught classes in magic and ritual for more than 30 years. She has founded three covens, plus an organization called Earthrite, which offered public rituals to her Northern California community for a dozen years. She also worked closely with eco-feminist and activist Starhawk during the early years of reclaiming, an activist branch of the modern pagan religion. Caradhwen regularly gives lectures tying together psychology, spirituality, history, contemporary issues, and politics. She is also the author of the new memoir, Broth from the Cauldron, A Wisdom Journey Through Everyday Magic, which will be released on May 12th. She's also published three historical novels based on her remembrances of her past lives. And she's joining us today from the Bay Area of California, where she is sheltering in place along with the rest of us. Caradhwen, welcome to the show.
Hey, so nice to see you, and so nice to be here.
Thank you. So since I referenced, you know, this meaning of the word witch, kind of thought that would be a good place to start. You call yourself a shamanic witch. So I would love to hear from you first. How would you describe what it means to be a witch? And I guess the second part of that question would be, is there any difference then between being a witch and a shamanic witch?
Yes, it's just a description. Witch is the colloquial term for Wicca, which is one of the native religious traditions of Celtic Europe. You know, both the Celtic countries and the European countries all had, were all pagan, you know, long before Christianity got there, of course. Yep. And so, you know, witch is originally from the same root word as willow or wicker. And willow is a tree that bends and moves with the wind. So the idea is that the witch is the one who follows the energy, who can move with the flow of things, like the flow of the Tao. So that's the original meaning of it. It was simply willow, the tree that moves and adapts and follows the twist. It's why witchcraft is also sometimes called the twisted path. It doesn't mean twisted in the sense of creepy or dysfunctional. It means twisted the way lightning comes down out of the sky. It's following the path of least resistance, or the way a river twists around the harder parts of rock in the landscape. That's the meaning of it, is that when you go with the flow, it doesn't tend to be a straight line. It tends to be a bit of a meander. And then, you know, in terms of shamanism, you know, many people, you know, you can call yourself, you know, people can call themselves a witch, and that has many different meanings. For instance, someone might be an herb witch or a hedge witch, which is very similar, where, you know, they do a lot of herbal remedies. Shamanism is, again, it's cross-cultural terminology, but what it means is someone who moves between the worlds, someone who in some way, whether through drugs or through hypnosis or through some other process, they move between the worlds and pay visits to the world of spirit. They talk to beings that are not of this world. They bring back the information and then they set right whatever has been put asunder, you know, where, for instance, in a friend of mine who was Athabascan from Alaska, you know, her people, her shamans would go to Nuliajik, who's the goddess who lives under the sea. And if there weren't enough seals or there's not enough fish coming to the nets, the shaman has to journey to Nuliajik and comb her hair while soothing her and then ask what they need to do to get the fish to come back or get the seals to come back. And the Nuliajik will tell them what they have done that has offended her, and then they set it right and everything is restored. So the idea, and whether, you know, sometimes it would be for a personal healing, someone's sick. So the shaman goes to Nuliajik and says, what has happened? Why is this person ill? And Nuliajik would tell them, oh, well, they forgot to leave offerings to me before they took all those seals. And they took more seals than they really ate. That's not acceptable to me. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry. We'll see that that's put right. So that the idea is that they're the intermediary or the intercessionary between the world of spirit and the world of matter. So a shaman is someone who takes journeys, someone who goes on quests into the other world and then brings back the information. Not all witches do that. You know, so when I say I'm a shamanic witch, I mean, that's kind of my specialty area, is making that kind of journey and return. And I'm very good at teaching it to people as well. One of the things I like the best about my ritual practice is when we all go on a journey together. You know, we all join consciousness and we all go on a journey at the same time to the same place, and we start seeing and hearing all the same things. So it's like dreaming together, and it's a really beautiful art form to do, and something that people are always amazed at how easily people's brains can sync up and how easily we can get on the same track and be in a mythical realm.
Oh, there's so much that you just said. I want to follow up on like five different things. I'm going to put a mental bookmark to come back, especially I love the image of the willow and the flow. And I definitely want to come back to that, and especially the idea of when we talk about what magic means, what it, you know, I think a lot of people think of it as like you're directing things, and what you're describing is something completely different and working, you know, with the elements, if I'm understanding that right. So I want to put a pin in that, to use really terrible corporate language here. But I want to ask you, as I had the privilege of reading your memoir, Broth from the Cauldron, which I loved, and I love to ask guests on the show just a little bit about their backgrounds and how they got to be who they are, because so many of us are not raised in homes or, you know, have childhood experiences that necessarily encourage that. And so in reading about your background, from what I understand, you were raised in a fairly conservative home in Southern California. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you becoming a shamanic witch was maybe not in your parents' vision of who you were going to be. Is that a fair statement?
Probably that's a very fair statement. Yes, I was always a bit of a trial to them. Although they should have known from the get-go when I kept, you know, my mother at one point, she was looking through a book of all the cute little, my first sayings when I was learning how to talk that my grandmother had kept track of. When my grandmother died, my mother got the book and she showed it to me, and every other thing was about witches. You know, every other thing I was talking about was witches. And she, after a while, she says, you see, you were always like this. We didn't encourage you in the slightest. It's not our fault. And I said, no, it's totally not your fault. You never encouraged me at all. So yeah, they had plenty of heads up, but I don't think it was what they were expecting. However, on the other hand, What is also true is that there's an immense amount of psychic ability on both sides of my family. Mm. And as much as they were trying to cover that up and pretend that that wasn't so, my father was very psychic indeed. He would have rather died than admitted it. But he had that quality in spades. So there's a certain way in which I come by it naturally. Also, I had the great good fortune of being brought up agnostic. My parents were Republican. My father was literally a rocket scientist. That's what he did for a living. He worked for aerospace. So I was brought up in a very scientific household. Probably if I'd been brought up, you know, in some Christian household, they would have killed me during an exorcism or something. So I got lucky. And we did a lot of camping when I was a kid. So I spent a lot of time outdoors. And I can remember my father saying on more than one occasion, why would anyone go to church when you could go hang out with the trees? And I was like, yeah, I relate to that. So there was a certain pagan undertone in terms of the love of nature, even though there was, of course, no ritual component at all. So in some ways, the apple was not as far from the tree as my family would have you believe.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and one thing that really stood out when I was reading your book too, is you were, you described some of these kind of magical experiences that you had as a child, that you talk about befriending a tarantula when you're very little, for example, or it seems like that you remembered past lives and details, like in quite a lot of detail as a young child. And one of the things that I was reflecting on as I was reading your book is I think that children, maybe we don't all come in exactly in that way. We don't all remember details to that level, but we do seem to inherently know that we have entered a world of magic, and that, that we see it and our imaginations are alive, all of that. And then for so many of us, it seems like we lose that based on the fact that maybe our parents didn't encourage it, or just all the cultural myth that gets thrown at us along the way. And then we have to recover it as we become adults again. And so I was really just thinking about how it didn't seem like that ever happened to you, that you were able to really hold on to that, that thread of magic and meaning, and that, you know, and I wouldn't say that you described it like this in the book, but that sense of I'm here for a reason. And I'm curious, your thoughts on how or why that was, how you were able to hold on to that, even if you weren't necessarily actively encouraged to develop those things.
Yeah, I would have to say it's probably just that it was such a strong part of my makeup that I simply wasn't able to let go of it, because I was actively trying to shut it down once I started to get to about 12. Mm. I was really trying hard to make it go away and put a lid on it. But it just wasn't working out for me. I tried. I was really, really wrestling with it a lot. But it just, I kept having. I mean, it's probably not the best time at 12 to try and start shutting it down, because then your kundalini energy is opening up, your sexual energy opening up, which opens up a whole nother level of your psychic energy. So I simply wasn't able to put a lid on it, I think is really, really the truth. And I think virtually all kids have some past life memories. I know I didn't say anything at all about past lives when my son was small, because I wanted to see if he would come up with it on his own. And he came up with all kinds of stuff. I remember at one point, at seven, he and a new friend walked into the house, and they said, we were brothers in a past life, and that's why we really love each other now. And then they walked off, and I was like, okay, they're just like very matter-of-factly, hey, you know what? And so I think it's very normal for kids to be, again, all humans are, psychic is anything special. It's just a form of intelligence, and we all have it. It's just that our culture has been so afraid of it that our culture tries to really suppress it. But
yeah,
it's not, something that only a few people have. It's just like mathematical ability. Some have a lot, some have a little, but it's just a normal part of the human brain.
Do you think that people are able to cultivated in the same way, like perhaps if you use the math analogy, like you study hard, then you might be really there people, for example, who always just know math and just get math, and then there are the people who really apply themselves. They're not natural at it, but they can develop an ability over time.
Absolutely. I get people at all different levels coming to my classes, and all of them will develop an immense amount during the course of a year if they take a year-long class with me. But of course, they start at different levels, so they'll end at different levels too. I've seen people have an immense amount of capacity, but who don't really work at it very much, and they don't progress as much, maybe, as someone who has less capacity, but they're determined, and so they're doing all the homework and really pushing themselves past their comfort zone. They're going to get a lot further than someone who's like, I'm starting to feel a little scared. I don't know why, but I'm not going to explore it, and I'm going to start going to avoidance here. It's like, well, you're not going to make it then. You know, that's not going to get you where you want to go.
Yeah.
You know, consciousness is hard. It's hard to be conscious, especially in a very unconscious society. And it's going to press your buttons like crazy as you try and develop that sense.
Yeah. And right. Yes. And you've got to really, I was going to say run up against your demons. I don't know if demons is the right word, but you got to face your shadow stuff. And that's hard to do.
That's for sure. I always, with my students, I was at the beginning, I say, so there's going to be days where you get up and you say, I really don't want to go. And you're going to want to make up some excuse not to go. And I said, if you're actively throwing up because you're sick to your stomach, I want you to stay home. But otherwise, I want you to just get in the car and get here. Mm-hmm. And please don't try and make up an excuse for yourself or me. Just get here. And then everyone will say, oh, that'll never happen to me. But sure enough, a couple sessions later, they're like, oh, I really don't want to go today. And it's always because they're about to have a breakthrough.
Oh, yeah.
And they're scared of it.
Yes. You know,
So that's just part of it. My second coven, we called ourselves the Holy Terrors because we recognize that there's a certain terror. Most terror means you should be running away very fast. But Holy Terror means that you're about to have a breakthrough and life is never going to be the same. And you got to keep going to get to that next level. So there's a holy terror that all of us have to court in order to make it to those higher levels.
Oh, I love that. Holy terror. Such a great reframing of that. The other thing that came to mind too is the movie The Matrix, you know, where, have you seen it? Yeah.
Red pill or the green pill, right?
Yes, right. And you know, he's like, you wish you took the other one, don't you? You know, when you get there. Because there are definitely those days you're like, could I have just stayed in the Matrix? Like, I'm okay over here. Not, yeah. Okay, one more question for you, kind of related to your upbringing. That again, so knowing what I read about you and your book and whatnot, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that Karen when Falling Star is not what your parents named you.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, it's traditional for witches to take a magical name. Hmm. So when I first got involved, I was 22, and I was at my first big summer solstice gathering, and I kept hearing the name Caradwyn, and I knew she was a goddess of some sort, but I really knew nothing about her. So I went and asked some of my elders, and they're like, oh, she's a pig goddess. I was like, a pig goddess, great. But I thought, well, I can get behind beneficial greed. That might be okay. But of course, it turns out Caradwyn actually has a whole lot of other aspects. She's the keeper of the cauldron, hence the title of my book, Broth from the Cauldron. And the cauldron that she has is the cauldron of transformation and creation. So all artists and authors and writers have to drink from her cauldron to be inspired. So that actually fit pretty darn well. And then at that same summer solstice, I was in a big circle of women, and a huge falling star came down from the sky, and I was the only one who saw it. Mm. And so that also seemed very significant to me. So I put those together and came up with my magical name. And after a while, everyone knew me by that name, and so I legally changed it from my original name.
It's a beautiful name, too. And Caradwyn is also a triple goddess, is she not?
Yeah, most of them were. They all have their maiden, mother, and crone aspects, although she's best known for her crone aspect, I think. But she's also known as the mother of, you know, two children. And one was the most beautiful girl in the world, and the other was the ugliest boy in the world. And so she decided to try and compensate for the boy's ugliness by making him this potion that had to be stirred for a year and a day. But she got a little boy named Gwyn to do the stirring, since obviously Caradwyn didn't want to stand in one place and stir for constantly for a year. But just as it was completing, he accidentally spilled 3 drops on his hand, and it burned him, so he put it in his mouth, and then suddenly he understood the language of birds. And what the birds were saying is, Caradwyn is going to come and kill you now. You'd better run. So he took off running and went through a whole series of transformations. So she's known as, yes, the mother who's trying to care for her children, but also as the crone who's going to be very angry at you if you don't do her bidding. So.
There's a lot of layers to that name. I like it.
Yes, there are.
So I have a question now, more because my path to the sacred feminine didn't really, it's been a different path here. And I personally have some confusion over the labels, you know, which labels are what they are, but, you know, Wiccan versus pagan and like where do you see yourself falling in that? And if there's a distinction at all that we need to name here.
Pagan is like an umbrella term that simply applies to any nature religion. All nature religions can be described as pagan, regardless of what culture they're from. In the same way that Christian is the umbrella term, and under that you have specific things like Catholic, Presbyterian, Baptist, right? Those are all the different flavors of Christian. So Wiccan is a flavor of pagan. It's just a specific descriptor of the very big umbrella term of pagan. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And is that where that's where you see yourself then? And
yeah, for me, I've studied, you know, with all different kinds of shamans and various people from various cultures. But I do identify the most strongly with Wicca, and that's definitely the base and the backbone of what I teach and what I practice. I like very much, and I feel fortunate to be oriented towards the tradition that is within my own hereditary basis. You know, I'm Scottish and a little bit of German, English, tiny bit of Native American, but mostly I'm, you know, half Scottish, which is the biggest piece. And I like that because then when I go and I talk and I work with people from other traditions, from other parts of the world, I'm not coming to try and steal what they've got. I'm coming and saying, oh, here's how we do it. Oh, you do it like that. Oh, that's really interesting. You know, we hobnob about the differences and the similarities between our traditions, but I'm bringing something to share and to offer instead of just coming with empty pockets saying, oh, fill me up. You know, the white people have taken everything else from you. Now we want to grab that too. So yeah. I feel fortunate that I have something that comes from my kind of lineage that then I can share with people from different lineages. It's not to say that I don't respect, at one point I was with a Native American shaman and he said that this was in the 70s, he said many of his people were criticizing him for working with white people. And he says, but so many of my people were killed. There's not enough red bodies for them to come back to. He says, if one of us comes back in a white body to me, I will not turn them away. And that was his feeling about it, was that it, you know, it matters what the spirit inside that person was. And I think that's true, that probably a lot of people who are say Native Hawaiian or Native American, or, you know, they, in their last life, that's what they're going to be attracted to. And, you know, I certainly have compassion for that situation, that that's what they're going to feel like they need to do, even though it's not a match with their current hereditary situation.
Yeah, I'm so glad you named this. I think this is one of an interesting both challenge on the spiritual path and a gift in, especially for women like myself of white European heritage, to reconnect with the sacred feminine, which for me, it's really been developing a deep relationship with the goddess. There's an ancestral reclaiming, I think, of, you know, we've got to go back pretty far, right? In my case, my family has been in some cases in the United States for nearly 400 years. Mm-hmm. So we're talking going way back, right? Like, you've got to go back a ways to tap into that wisdom, but it's absolutely there. So I can kind of find, you know, back my way back to my heritage. And then I don't have to feel like I'm taking from other cultures. And that feels really important to me. But one of the challenges for me too has also been just the recognition that you know, dominator culture and colonialism, it destroyed a lot of our heritage too. It really did. And so, yeah, there are times when I feel like we're making it up. We're totally making it up on the fly because we don't have our grandmothers and great grandmothers. They weren't in a place to teach us these things. And I wonder if you have a perspective on that.
Well, you know, one of my elders, you know, who was a friend and teacher of mine, she said, "I practice magic exactly the way my ancestors did 60,000 years ago. I make it up." So, I mean, somebody made everything up sometime,
honey. You're so right. You're so right.
Well, we're just as good at making it up as our ancestors were. And I think that's actually a strength in some ways of our broken tradition and our rewoven tradition, is that we can make it up so that it fits where we are now. I know when I've studied with traditional people, often I'll say, "Oh, so why are we doing it this way?" And I'll say, "Oh, well, grandfather did it this way." I was like, "Okay, why did grandfather do it this way?" "Well, probably because his grandfather did it." You know, they don't have any idea. Mm-hmm. They have something that's been passed down, but they don't have any container for why they're still doing it. And that can be a little bit of a limitation as well as a strength.
Yeah.
I think we have to look at the bright side of we are creating a new pagan traditions for now, for right now, and for who we are now. And we can take as much or as little as we want from the past. We can think about, oh, okay, do we like this tradition? Do we want to keep that going? Or maybe is it time to let that rest? You know, people so often get stuck. Look at foot binding in China. What a horrible thing that was. And people could say, "Oh, well, but that's part of our tradition." It's like, well, but it's an awful tradition. So it's good that was released, because sometimes things have served their purpose. Sometimes they came from an unconscious place. And as we get more conscious, it doesn't fit anymore.
I love that perspective. And you also are bringing me in mind back to what you said in the beginning about witch and the word willow, which really means to bend and flow with energy. So that, of course, you know, we get too rigid anywhere, then we're not flowing. And I can't imagine that any tradition was meant to stay exactly the same for thousands and thousands of years, because we haven't stayed the same and the world hasn't stayed the same.
Right. Everything changes. And yet at the same time, you know, friends, I have a friend in Hawaii who's almost pure Hawaiian. Both his parents were kahu, so they were of that priest shaman class of people. He grew up in a very magical household. Neither of his parents were literate. You know, they were people who were really functioning on the old ways. And I was the first white person he'd met who practiced magic. And we would talk for a while, and he'd say, "Talking to you is like talking to the old people." And you know, that he recognized that the track I was on was very much similar. Yeah. Similar, not at all the same in terms of, you know, the specifics, but that there was a similarity to what I was doing, to what he grew up with.
Mm. Yeah, I think that there's also a universal current when we get still, when we sort of step out of the swirl of culture and we tune into the natural world and what's actually happening. There's that truth that's underneath. And then, so when you find other people, whatever spiritual path they've been on and whatever their cultural background is, they've dropped into that, then it's, you're going to feel like you're meeting, you know, even if like little details are different, you're still, right. You've found the same stream, you know, you're swimming in the same stream, I guess.
Yeah. Good way to say it. Yeah.
Well, I think, as you know, this show is all about the sacred feminine. And for me, I think that, you know, my big passion is helping people reconnect with that divine feminine wisdom. Not exclusively, not because I think we're trying to create some sort of opposite of what we have now, but just because it's been so suppressed for so long. And the reclaiming of that is a way to find wholeness. And so I like exploring that in all different ways, you know, whether that's through, I'm kind of a geek, like my first entryway into this was history and learning some of the history that I was never taught in school. But also I think there's, you know, the pleasure aspect of reclaiming the sacredness of our bodies and sexuality. There's the eco-feminist aspect of really finding the goddess in Mother Earth. And I'm wondering on your path where you see how the sacred feminine weaves into that, because it does. Well, you know what? I'm going to stop there. I'm going to let you answer that.
Obviously, you know, again, Wicca, we honor, what I love about it is it honors both the goddess and the god. It honors the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine and sees them as somewhat inseparable. So I love that about it, that it has that honoring of those currents. And of course, we ourselves are both, you know, the sacred marriage has to take place within us. The masculine and the feminine has to harmonize within us. When that happens, then you might be able to have a sacred marriage with another person, whether that person's of your same gender or a different gender, doesn't matter, because again, that's the true balance has to happen internally. If you're always looking for somebody else to complete you on the outside, there's always going to be, it's going to introduce problems into your relationship. So I love that about it. I love the, everyone has different ideas of what the feminine energy is. For me, the earth, much of the earth feels feminine, but there's aspects that feel very masculine. Sometimes the apus, the mountains feel very, very yang to me, you know, the mm-hmm. rocks and all that. The moon generally feels feminine and the sun masculine. But again, that's probably just because how I was raised in Japan. The sun goddess is Amaterasu, you know, they see her as female. So it's not like there's a masculine feminine thing that's really true. It's just a matter of feeling it. And again, feeling the divine feminine, which I've felt, you know, as a maiden with my sexuality, although my sexuality is still very alive today, that passion is mm-hmm. part of the sacred feminine to me. Aphrodite is my core goddess. The mother, you know, being pregnant, giving birth. Wow. You know, what an incredible feminine experience that is. It's a remarkable thing and a wonderful thing to be able to participate in. And and then the crone, you know, the part that I'm at now with being the old woman, being the teacher, being the helper, being the guide, all of those things are also very important to me. Being the grandmother, I love being a grandmother. What a great thing. I love it. Probably the thing I like best about being an older woman is my relationship with younger women. You know, that younger women thrive and benefit so much from having an older woman take them under her wing and nurture them and support them and educate them. You know, it's so important for young women to have that. And so it's very fulfilling on both sides, you know, for the older woman's wisdom to be received and the younger woman to be nurtured and brought forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sometimes about how much we have lost culturally by not valuing the wisdom of the crone. What a shame! I mean, we do this with men and with women in our culture, just sort of shunning people as they age, but particularly with women. And there was a book that I read a while ago, I think Jamie Sams had written it about, I forget what it's called now, the 13 original clan mothers, I believe. But in it, she said that in her tradition, in her native tradition, that women weren't even considered to be fully adult until the age of 52. Like you were still maturing up until that point. And right. I loved that perspective so much of that. Oh, we have so much to look forward to. We have so much wisdom to give as we age.
Yeah, and that's definitely kind of the core thing about growing older. Yeah, if you look at, you know, just the memes, like you look at people, you know, people go crazy for Bernie Sanders, and a lot of that is because he fulfills that meme of the wise wizard who's coming to save us. You know, he's Gandalf, he's Dumbledore, he's Merlin. Well, what can Hillary Clinton be? She can only be the Wicked Witch.
Yeah,
because we don't have any grandmothers coming to save us, and we're still wrestling with this. It's going to be a while, you know. Women are very, you know, even in my own my third coven, when we started going into menopause and I started naming it, people freaked out. Women were like, no, I'm not going into menopause. I'm still young. And I was like, whoa, really? Are we going to fight this? I mean, this is our third stage. Let's ritualize it and move forward. Women are only valued for how much men desire them in this culture, pretty exclusively.
Yeah.
You know, so to lose that male attention feels like death, because it's, you know, then you no longer exist in any meaningful way. And that's, again, is something we really have to work on and shift. And, you know, we women have to start it with ourselves and with each other, is respecting and honoring and asking ourselves, why am I so, like, why do I want to try and pretend that I'm 30? Why am I so desperate to stay, you know, to resist my aging and my natural empowerment, you know, in the same way that, you know, when a fruit wrinkles up, you know, like an apricot, it tastes more intense. There's an intensity, you know, as we get older, it's really quite flavorful. And it's too bad that people don't get excited about that, because it's really worth getting excited about.
Well, and this kind of feels like a good place to ask this question. You know, we're talking about sort of the ways in which women are only feel like we're valued for our looks and whatnot. But obviously there's a much deeper component, like what that does to our psyches, what that tells us about our contributions to culture and whatnot. And I'm curious what you think. Maybe you can reflect in your own life what being on this path of witchcraft and all that means in terms of the sacred feminine, how that's helped you steer through all of this toxic soup that we tend to live in.
Right. Well, of course, yes. Again, it helps to be in a spiritual tradition that honors that third stage, that honors the crone, and that says, wow, this is the penultimate level of power, is to achieve crone or sage. Do you know that the female word for sage is saga? A saga is a story. Right. And the saga is the one who has the words of power.
Wow.
And that's where we get that term saga, as a story. And everyone knows the word sage, but nobody uses the feminine saga to talk about us old women. So I teach classes on the crone, interestingly enough, you know, to try and educate people more about that stage and about honoring it and celebrating it and owning it and not being so afraid of this part. And, you know, a lot of it is just, you just have to get strong enough in yourself to not be tossed away by what your culture is thinking or saying about you. I mean, the fact is, I'm not going to criticize any woman, including myself, for wanting love. Of course we want love. We want cuddling. We want sex. We want love. We want companionship. This is a basic human need. You know, humans we're pack animals. We're, you know, people like to glorify a lone wolf, but a lone wolf is a sick wolf. Humans are pack animals. We need each other. And so for women not to have a partner, not to have intimacy, is a particularly grievous wound for us. And it really is a wound. It's not, you know, I'm not going to sweep that under the rug and say, oh, you shouldn't mind. Of course you're going to mind. There aren't enough good guys to go around. And that's a sad fact right now. And it's getting better with each generation, you know, that there's a bigger percentage of the actual healthy, growing, strong men, you know, that anyone would want to be with. There's many more in my son's generation than in mine. And hopefully a lot more, there'll be a lot more in my granddaughter's generation than in his. But, you know, that's the fact, is there's women in my generation in great numbers with the feminist movement started going to therapy, having conscious raising groups. A whole lot of us opened up our thinking and changed and grew in powerful ways. And a much smaller contingent of the men went along with that. And that's just the reality. There's a numbers disparity. It's a big numbers disparity. And so the question is really, why aren't men stepping up to the plate a little more?
I'm so glad you said that, because this feels like this kind of feeds into this. I wanted to ask you about this concept of divine masculine and divine feminine. And one of the things that you write in your book is you say, women are often drawn to paganism because it offers strong female role models in the form of goddesses. But men in our culture are equally in need of healthy male gods, gods who sit side by side with their goddess mates as equals, and are not threatened by them. And I do wonder if that feeds into this lack of, you know, there's a whole different conversation we could have here about what men have been taught by seeing only patriarchal gods. And even if you're not religious, how that, you know, filters into every aspect of our culture. But I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the goddess and the god are meant to, you know, as I said, sit side by side, be equals. When a man is strong in himself, he's not threatened by the powerful feminine. I know when my son was small, I would say women have the big, strong hips so they can push the babies out, and men have the big, strong shoulders so they can put the baby on their shoulder once they're out and carry around the little kids very easily. And he was very satisfied with that idea of, you know, the women had this thing and the men had this strength over here. Those broad shoulders, it's like a tip off that the man's strength is his heart. That's meant to be his strong place. And our culture damages men's in their hearts so much, just in the same way that a woman's strength is in her hips. Her sexuality is actually her core strength. And that's where our culture works to cut women apart from their power, mm-hmm. from their sexuality. So our culture very, very much targets our areas of actual strength and integrity and tries to flip them around and make it so that we'll be somewhat helpless, and then we'll buy any amount of BS that's given to us and hand over our money in exchange for something that doesn't help us in any way. So it's both men and women who are damaged in this culture, very much so. And the one of the tricks is, one of the ways in which men are damaged is they're told they're not supposed to ask for help. They're told they're supposed to be know-it-all and think it all through, and then so they can't go to therapy and they can't get, you know, it's like there's a huge resistance on the male part to admit that maybe they need some support because they're trained not to admit it. So that's the big thing to break through, is for men to recognize that vulnerability can actually be the key to their strength. The other thing that I think most people don't realize in our culture is that men have the young, active, outgoing bodies. But women have the young, active, outgoing minds. Hmm. Men's brains are actually more yin, and women's brains are actually more yang.
Interesting.
And this is something so men know that they're supposed to be rational, but if you look at how men get very emotional very quickly, men have an emotion reaction first. It's way up front. And women have this very, well, if we do this, then we can do that. And then we'll do this, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do this. And they're very linear, and they're very rational, and they're thinking it all through. Hmm. I mean, think about how men and women are different sexually. If the woman looks good, the man's just like, whoa, boom, he's there. He's all there. He's like, whoa, oh, he's all turned on. He's ready to go. And the woman's like, well, let's see, what kind of underwear do I have on? It's only the third day. Is that going to be okay? Let's see. Now, she's going through a checklist. Boom, he's ready to go. You know, again, the man has the immediate emotional response, very present. The woman's all past, future, past, future, past, future. And thinking very, very, like Elizabeth Warren, be the poster child for how women think. She's got a plan for everything. This is how women are. We have a plan, and we think through our plan. We obsess about the details of our plan. We have got it together. And the masculine's like, well, you know, I'm just going to wing it. I have a hunch. I have a feeling. I trust my gut about this. You know, and it's all very, I'm going to make this up as I go along. Basically, there's a guide that I always tell people. I say, you know, it's easy to know the truth. Take whatever our culture says and flip it 180 degrees around. Boom, there's the truth. It's whatever the culture says, 180 degrees from wherever the culture tells you it is. Mm. They say, oh, men are rational, men are logical. All you have to do is think about this for a bit and you'll realize this ain't the way. Mm-hmm. But men desperately think they're supposed to be that way, and they try very, very hard to make it look that way. Mm-hmm. They're told that that's who they are.
Yeah. I love the idea of, of course, and you already said it earlier, that we know that we have both masculine and feminine, you know, and that goes beyond how you identify, you know, with your gender and whatnot, right? But I love the idea of even like a very tangible example of like being, you know, yang in the head and yin in the body and the opposite for men. Like I love that. That's a very real way to think about it. That's neat. Well, I want to make sure, I feel like I can't talk to a witch without talking about magic. I mean, that's just wrong. Like we got to talk about magic. I wanted to ask you, and I think maybe you've answered this a little bit. Well, this is what I was extrapolating when you were talking about the word witch and the flow and moving with energy. So you maybe have already answered this, but I wanted to ask you how you see and view and experience magic in your life.
Yeah, magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. Some people have called it coincidence control. Magic is coincidence control. So there's the yin and the yang. There's assertion. This is what I want to happen. And then there's surrender, where, you know, so it's like the flow and then the ebb, where you put out what you want and then you make space for that or something better to happen, which is why many people will do a spell and they'll say, let this or something better happen. If it harms none, let this be what happens. So people will usually put a little caveat on it. So that if the goddess wants to give you something in a different direction than what you thought, that won't be impeded. For instance, I had a friend who at one point, his wife had broken up with him and he was very heartbroken and he was doing a spell to get her back. But at the last moment, as he was doing the spell, instead of saying her name, he said, send my true love to me, without specifying who that was. And 2 weeks later, he met the woman that he then spent the next 40 years until she died, till the end of her life with. And he was very, very glad that he hadn't insisted on what he absolutely knew to be the facts, which was he wanted that person he already had, but that he let that space open for the goddess to bring him the best possible person, who turned out was someone entirely different. So it's assertion and it's surrender. It's you put it out and then you let it go. Because sometimes, so much of the time, I mean, I just say the goddess just picks me up by the scruff of the neck and puts me wherever she wants because, you know, how much choice do I really have about this? It seems like less than that, honestly. So there is a surrender element. People almost always get involved with magic or witchcraft thinking they're going to control everything.
Yes.
And that's very much the New Age thing too. You're creating your own reality. As if you could do that completely independent of everyone else's reality. No human is an island. You know, one person's experience does affect somebody else's experience. And that's why we need to evolve ourselves together and not see it as just an individual, rugged individualist project, but to see it as how can I lift up the people near me so that we can all have a better reality together.
Yeah. And that feels especially important to me right now. I mean, we are, you know, here we are. I'm in the Bay Area too. So we are now in what, week 7, 8? I don't know. It's all running together of this shelter in place. We're going to be here until the end of May, I've now heard. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but you know, eventually, because all things shift and change, we're going to get out of here. Like we will move through this pandemic, however we move through it as a culture, as a species. But then we've also got to face all the other stuff that we're still dealing with, right? Which is, you know, I mean, we still have climate change. Like this, this may be the tip of the iceberg for what we have ahead of us still. And so I'm curious in your perspective on how this path of Wiccan and the witchcraft that you have walked these so many years, how that might be useful and beneficial to us as we navigate whatever we're going to face.
Yeah, I'm hoping, you know, I mean, I'm very much hoping that more people will come around towards egalitarian thinking and towards honoring and worshiping the earth. You know, if we could return more people to that pagan sense of the earth is sacred, the earth is the goddess, that is the body of the goddess. We can't harm the body of the goddess. Mm-hmm. If we have that level of reverence, we're going to have a very different relationship. You know, it's not just about having goddesses. I mean, if you look at India still has goddesses, very patriarchal, same with Japan.
Yeah. So
unfortunately, just having the goddess isn't enough. It has to be a deeper level at which people are really honoring the goddess and really clear that the goddess is the planet around us and not just an abstract idea out there that you can leave a little offering on the altar and then you walk away and, you know, don't take a honoring of the feminine with you. So it's, you know, it has to be at a deeper, at that deeper level.
Yeah. It's been my hope too, that, you know, that in this time of pandemic where a lot of us have been sent home, and I want to acknowledge that's not true for everybody. And that, you know, I've heard a lot of people saying like, oh, people have time on their hands to think about these deep things. Yeah. Well, a small group of people do in fact have time on their hands, and the others are hustling, trying to figure out how to, you know, pay their bills still, or, you know, homeschool their children and get their work done. All of the above. Right. Right. Or they're sick or taking care of people who are sick. But in general, I do think that, it's a beautiful opportunity as much as a scary opportunity, a difficult opportunity. It's creating, spaciousness kind of globally to think about who we are and who we want to be. And, it's my hope and daily prayer that we use it as an opportunity and an opening to begin to shift into balance with each other and with the rest of the natural world.
Yeah. I really noticed with some of the people who are coming out protesting against this and being very angry, like I could see how frightened they were being at home where they were confronting themselves. These are people who always have operated with denial and putting things under the rug, and things were coming to the surface and that was unbearable. And they needed that outer distraction again.
Yeah.
And is that frantic? You can't make me sit at home and think. I'm going to get out and get busy so I don't think anymore. Like, you could really see that was so much of the motivation. Again, I'm not at all criticizing people who are afraid of losing their homes and want to go back to work so they don't lose their homes. I understand. It's very scary. But there was also, I could see an immense wanting to flee from the emotions and the potential realizations that were starting to arise.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, we've got another at least month of this to go, and who knows what's going to emerge from it. I tell you what, if you need a good book to read during this time, I can recommend one for you. It's called Brought from the Cauldron, A Wisdom Journey Through Everyday Magic. I really enjoyed this. It's divided into short, easy to read chapters, lots of nuggets of wisdom here. So it's going to be out May 12th. And Caradwyn, thank you so much for joining me here today. It's been such a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Thank you. It's been absolutely delightful to talk to you too.
Wonderful. And as always, if you guys like this show, I would really appreciate it if you would tell a friend about it, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And if you just think it's amazing, you can do all three. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon. Is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.